What a great reminder. Happy Easter, everybody. So glad that you've joined us today for worship. On October 3rd, 2010, it was my first Sunday, my first sermon as senior pastor of this church. And it was also the first sermon that we went through together in this Gospel of Mark. October 3rd, 2010. And here we are on March 31st, 2013, in the last sermon in this Gospel of Mark. It's been this anchor series for us for several years now. And if you've been a part of Grace for a while, you know that this has been this series that we continue to come back to. And Mark has shared tremendous insight with us about following Jesus and what it looks like. And we started this whole series. I went back and read over that very first sermon in Mark. We started this series talking about how Mark is written for ordinary people. And I realize in a crowd like this that some of us come to the Bible and we read the Bible or we hear stories from the Bible and we feel like failures. We hear stories about Moses and say, I read that story about Moses and I just don't have leadership like that. Or I read the story of Abraham and I realize I just don't have that kind of faith. Or I see the story of Paul and recognize that I'm just not filled with that kind of passion or devotion like Paul was. And even the most accomplished in this room, in business, in finance, even the best parent, even the most accomplished person in education, can still look at the Bible and say, you know, those Bible heroes are great, but I know myself. And that's not me. Because sometimes I'm not so spiritual. In fact, most days, if given the choice, you might say, if given the choice between helping somebody else and gratifying myself, man, so often I choose myself. Like if it's a Saturday morning and I don't have a whole lot going on and I have the choice between waking up and going and serving at a soup kitchen or laying on the couch and watching TV, I choose the couch most days. Or if I'm faced with a decision of praying over a big decision or just figuring it out myself, I tend to lean toward figuring it out. Or if I have the choice between forgiving someone or holding a grudge, so often I choose the grudge. You may think, well, I'm just not there. I'm just not some spiritual giant. And the great comfort that we've taken in walking through this Gospel of Mark is that it was written by a man who knew what it was like to try to follow Jesus and fail. This is the guy that was fired from ministry by the Apostle Paul, Mark. And he reminds us again and again through his gospel that the Christian life isn't for superstars. It's for people who try and fail and try again. And God uses these ordinary, unexpected people. And so I ask you this morning, do you know anything about failure? Anybody? Because you look pretty perfect. You look good. I mean, even I look good today, right? I don't normally do this, but, you know, today's an important day. So we're coming down this home stretch in Mark, and even during these last couple months, this theme has ramped up of failure, discipleship failure. The disciples just keep failing. In fact, in our creative teams, we're sitting there looking at each other going, man, this has been a long stretch of people failing Jesus. And we come to the end of Mark in chapter 16, verses 1 through 8, and Mark is the weirdest ending of any of the gospel writers. It's a crazy ending. And you might have more in your Bible past verse 8, but we're going to stop at verse 8 because that's where the earliest manuscripts stopped. Most believe that some of what came later was added on. It probably says that right in your Bible. But where Mark stops in verse 8 is a weird ending. It's not what you would expect. And so we're going to unpack that today because I believe it's for a very important reason that Mark ends his gospel this way. And my big idea this morning is that the only way to overcome failure is to go and meet the risen Lord. And so when you read the Bible, if you feel like a failure, it's okay, because so do these main characters in Mark's gospel. And the reminder today is that if you feel like a failure, the only way to overcome your failure is to go and meet the risen Lord. So we're going to go in Mark 16, starting in verse 1. If you've got a Bible or a phone or an iPad or whatever, you can turn there. If not, the words will be on the screen here. We'll talk about it as we go. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And so we pick up the story. It's Sunday morning. The rising of the sun that Sunday morning dispels the darkness that had covered the whole land at the crucifixion. It also marks symbolically the beginning of the dawning of a brand new day for humanity. As I talked to you a couple weeks ago about the way Mark writes, especially as we come down the home stretch here, he adds these details. He adds lots of details because I think Mark's making a case for the fact that this actually happened. He's not writing fairy tales here. He's writing history. This is a historical account. And so he names these women by name. There's three women, and they were probably still alive at the time of Mark's writing. And so it's as if Mark is saying, listen, here's the three women that went to the tomb. They're still alive. They live right over here. Go talk to them. They were the first ones on the scene at Jesus' resurrection. But another detail that brings this story incredible credibility is that women were the first ones on the scene. These women were also at the cross. They had been part of Jesus' band of disciples, and they were the first eyewitnesses to the resurrection of Jesus. Now, I say that that's an important factor to consider because in that day, the testimony of women wasn't even admissible in a court of law. Celsus, a Greek philosopher from the second century, used this very fact to dismiss the credibility of Christianity. He said, "Christianity can't be true," said Celsus, "because the written accounts of the resurrection are based on the testimony of women. And we all know that women are hysterical." Now, I didn't say it. I looked up at the wrong time. I looked up and made it seem like I was saying that. That's actually part of the quote. Because I don't think that. But Celsus, the second century philosopher. And so here's the point. If Mark was trying to make up a believable account, if he was trying to make up from scratch a convincing story to help get some movement off the ground back then, he would have never written the story this way. He would have had like the heroes of the story, like Jesus' main guys, the disciples, come and find the resurrection. He would have never written it this way. The only explanation is that it actually happened this way. So the women come to the tomb and they wonder who will roll the stone away. And their problem gets solved in a way that they never imagined. Look at verse 4. "And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back, and it was very large." And so this is a round stone. It was hewn right out of the face of the rock. They would roll this big stone down an incline and into a groove in front of the opening of a tomb. Some of these stones weighed up to 2 tons, and they were so heavy to keep out grave robbers and wild animals that would come and try to mess with the bodies. And so they're wondering, logically, how are we going to move that enormous stone? Matthew's account also tells us that Roman guards were there guarding the tomb. A Roman guard unit was 11 to 18 trained soldiers. They were highly disciplined. They knew that if they fell asleep or failed to do their job in any way, it meant death for them. And then we find out that the tomb was officially sealed. It was wrapped in a cord, and a big thing of wax was put on there, and they put a Roman seal on the tomb. And if anyone broke the seal, they knew that breaking the seal meant that they would incur the wrath of Rome. And we'd already seen what Rome can do. Verse 5, "And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, 'Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him.'" Now, can you imagine the scene? They came to anoint a corpse, and the corpse wasn't there. The angel says, he's not here, he's risen. And the tomb is empty. I want to remind you today that the tomb is empty. The tomb's empty. This fact was a huge factor for me when I was coming to renewed faith in Jesus. I had given up on Christianity. I had walked away. I was researching all of these other world religions. But there was this pesky fact that stayed in the back of my head that over in the Middle East somewhere, there's an empty tomb that doesn't have a body in it anymore. And if that's true, I need to do something about that. And so that there's all these theories that have emerged about what happened with the body. Mike talked last weekend about the swoon theory, that maybe Jesus didn't actually die. And he did a great job of unpacking it. You can go back on the podcast and catch up with that. But it's nonsense. Most thinkers have moved on from that theory. But another theory is the wrong tomb theory, that the women actually, and then subsequently the disciples, showed up at the wrong tomb. That they came to a tomb and it was empty, and they just assumed that was the tomb of Jesus. The women were walking through the streets and they were like, well, my directions say we take a left at 4th and Fig, and they said, no, we take a right here, and they just got messed up. And we all know that would never happen because the women would ask for directions. If it were the guys, we know that they could have got lost. But here's the problem with this theory, though, the wrong tomb theory. The problem is the early dramatic rise of Christianity in the world. You see, this movement did take off. It took off like a shot. And the Jews and the Romans at the time desperately wanted to squash this movement. They didn't want it to work. They didn't want it to work well. And so if they had showed up just at the wrong tomb, it would have been very easy for the Jews and the Romans to go to the right tomb to produce the body and say, these people are crazy. Come over here. Here's the tomb. But they didn't. Another theory is that the Jews and the Romans stole the body to try to put down any kind of craziness in the streets that was going to happen around the tomb of Jesus, that they took the body. But again, the problem is the same. If this, as this movement of Christianity took off, they could have just produced the body and said, these people are believing a myth, a lie. It's just a big hoax. But no body was produced. Some would say that the disciples stole the body. The disciples came and took the body. In fact, this was the explanation of the religious leaders in Matthew 28, 11 to 15. But here's what we would assume that would have had to have happened if the disciples had stole the body. Just from a logistical standpoint, it's very difficult to believe. Because what we'd had to have thought is that they fought through those armed guards that I just talked about a second ago. These fearful disciples fought through that unit of guards. They steal the body. We find out in the New Testament that there was many hundreds of post-resurrection appearances of Jesus' body where people saw him alive. Some 500 people at a time would see him alive. This means that the disciples somehow had to get his body in such a way that people believed not only that he was alive, but that he was worthy of worship. And so we've got this crazy Weekend at Bernie's thing going on where they're walking around trying to make this mangled body look like it was worthy of worship. But beyond the logistical stuff, anybody see that movie? That's a good one. I just thought, I haven't seen it in a while. That's a good one. But we have to account for a couple of things with the disciples too. I mean, if they stole the body and they knew that this was just a big hoax, how do you explain the change in the disciples' demeanor? They went from fear and all of these denials and betrayals and hiding in fear in the upper room to being these bold witnesses of the resurrection, willing to risk their lives for this message that they somehow knew in the back of their heads was a big hoax. They changed completely. Not only that, we find out that 10 of the 11 remaining disciples were actually killed for their beliefs. They were martyred in horrific ways. People don't get tortured and martyred for something that they know to be a lie. So there's an empty tomb. And I haven't yet come across a theory that explains why that tomb is empty. It's what brought me back to the Savior when I was 20 years old. And because another option with the empty tomb is that he is who he says he is, and he did what he said he would do. And so what if it really happened? I mean, I ask us for collectively here, what if it really happened on that Easter morning a couple thousand years ago, that Jesus came back from the dead? He conquered death and sin. Because we can't just go on with our ho-hum lives knowing that that's a reality. It means that all the other stuff that he said was true is also true. It means that you and I have access to God, that you and I have the promise of the Spirit of God in us, that you and I have meaning and purpose for our lives. Verse 7. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you to Galilee, and there you will see him just as he told you. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The end. The end. They're witnesses to the resurrection. The angel tells them to go tell the disciples. They're afraid. They said nothing to anybody. The end. Now, it's ironic that the angel even told them to go tell people, because remember, through the whole Gospel of Mark, every time Jesus did a miracle or something spectacular, he was telling them, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody what's happening. It's this messianic secret theme. And they would go and tell anyway. And now the angel says, go tell everybody. And they don't tell anybody. And Mark's gospel is filled with this fear and trembling reaction. We see it throughout with the disciples and his followers. When the sea was calmed, they were afraid. When Jesus walked on water, they were afraid. At the transfiguration, there was trembling. On the road to the cross, we see them abandoning Jesus in droves because of their fear. And Mark, in this ending, puts an exclamation point on his discipleship failure theme. That when followers of Jesus follow him, they will fail him. And that goes for you and I too. We will fail him. Every one of us has a story that involves failure when it comes to spiritual stuff. Do you know why? Because of sin. We have this terrible sin problem. We talked about it two nights ago. And we aren't sinners just because we do sins. We do sins because we're sinners. It's a deep problem. It's a deep affliction that has affected every one of us. It runs deep. And so we see these sins of betrayal and cowardice as we read this account. But we see it in us too, and we can relate. Now, I want to look at these characters real quick and just see their failure. The disciples in this text failed to show up. The disciples failed to show up. Jesus told them no less than 10 times that he would die and come back from the grave. And for all of these disciples, not one of them thought to come and check out that claim. Not one of them thought to come to the tomb. And listen, some of you guys have failed to show up. You've been away from Christianity for a long time. And maybe you look back in the rearview mirror of your life and you just remember a stale experience when you were a kid with religion or church. And you've thrown in the towel on the whole thing. You haven't showed up in a long time. In fact, maybe today is your first reattempt to show up to Christianity. And I want to encourage you that there is a second chance with your name on it. And I also want to remind you that you will never find ultimate meaning and purpose in your life. You will never find that connection to the transcendent that you're longing for if you don't show up. But the women failed too. The women failed to wise up. I'm not trying to be snarky here, but they just didn't get it. They didn't understand what was going on. They had also heard, because they were followers of Jesus too, they had also heard that he was coming back from the dead. And I give them credit because they actually showed up. These were strong women. They said, we don't care about the dangers. We're going to go to the tomb and do our thing. The problem was they came to anoint a corpse, not to witness a resurrection. They came with the wrong expectations. because they didn't understand what was going on. And some of you, like the women, are showing up with the wrong expectations. Maybe you come to church, maybe you come to a group, and you're going through the motions. You're doing it because of tradition or duty or to memorialize something in your past, but you're not showing up to encounter the risen Christ. The key for you is to not accept going through the motions and faking it as the norm. It's to commit yourself again to forward motion. But Peter, who's mentioned here by name, Peter failed to live up to his calling. Jesus said, Peter, you're the rock. Upon this rock I will build my church. Remember a couple of chapters ago that Peter was looking at Jesus when Jesus said, everybody's going to fail me. And Peter says, no, I won't. If everybody else fails you, Jesus, I'm going to be by your side. And Jesus looks right back at him and he says, no, you're going to fall. You're going to fail. But I have a plan. And what's quoted here in this text is a quote from 14:28, where Jesus said, right in the midst of that little speech by Peter, Jesus said, but after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. And so the angel in the tomb repeats these words of Jesus, and he says, head to Galilee. Jesus is going to be there to meet you, just as he told you back in 14:28. He told you that this was going to happen exactly this way. You see, Jesus had already accounted for their failures. He already had accounted for their failures. He knew they weren't going to come to the cross. He knew they weren't going to come to the tomb. He said, so to just take that out of the equation, I'll meet you in Galilee after the dust has settled a bit. Jesus already had this plan B in place. And there are those of you in this room who have failed to be faithful to God. Maybe you've been a Christian for a long time and you've been on this journey of failure for a while and you can see the telltale signs. Your heart is growing cold. You're not feeling the things that you once felt when you see them. I want to remind you and encourage you today that Jesus has made other arrangements. There's still a road out for you. There's still a pathway back to Him. He says, I've gone ahead of you. Now just come and meet me. You see, when it comes to Jesus, so many of us fail. So many of us can relate to this story. We can relate to this ending in Mark. We fail to show up like the disciples. And we fail to wise up like the women. And we fail to live up to our calling like Peter. And we fail to keep up. And we fail to stay up and clean up. And we fail to make up. And we fail to shut up or grow up or open up or look up. Some of us fail to cowboy up. And I could go on. But here's the message of the empty tomb. Jesus never fails. Jesus never fails. He keeps his promises. He told them all along that this would happen and it would happen like this. He went to the cross where he reversed the curse of dying and death, and then he sealed that reversal through coming back to life in the resurrection. And some people say, well, I just don't feel God's love. Let me remind you that feelings aren't always incredibly reliable. Can I get an amen on that? Feelings aren't always incredibly reliable. We know that. Here's what is reliable. Here's what is sure. That there is an empty cross and an empty tomb outside Jerusalem that proves to you, anytime you doubted, that Jesus loves you. It proves to you the unfailing love of Christ, whether you feel it or not. He's available. And just like he was willing to meet the disciples at Galilee, he's also ready and willing to meet you. And this book, Mark, ends abruptly on a note of failure because the gospel is for failures. And Mark subtly points us to the solution. He says, by the ending, he says, now go and meet the risen Lord. Go and meet the risen Lord. You see, faith to Mark is this radical surrender and commitment of ourselves to the risen Lord. And that when we do that, only then can we overcome our failures. So my encouragement to you today is to go and meet the risen Lord. In the midst of your failure, go and meet the risen Lord. Keep pursuing him. Jump into that group that you've been thinking about getting in. Get on that YouVersion reading plan that you've been debating about. Give us 4 weeks here at Grace as we go through this idea of forgiveness during the month of April. Keep pursuing him. Keep taking the right steps. I think one of the main reasons that Mark ends his account this way is because the resurrection isn't the ending of the story. It's only the beginning. And we know from history that all of this failure that was wrapped up in these last two verses with the disciples and the women and Peter, all of that failure gets turned on its head. You see, the women eventually did tell the disciples, and the disciples eventually did come out of hiding, and Peter eventually did lead a spiritual revolution through the early church, and this cowardly group was transformed into a group of world changers almost overnight. We're forced to ask, well, how did that happen? Why the dramatic change? How did they overcome their failures? The same way we can overcome ours. Not through self-help books, not through the power of positive thinking, not by joining the right church, not by trying really hard to be moral, not a 12-step group, not finding that someone special, not finding the right therapist. Failure is real, and it's the result of sin, but the only way that we overcome our darkest failures is to meet the risen Lord. He's the only hope that we have. There's a story of failure in my own life, and I'll wrap up with this. So 13 years ago, Kim and I had adopted a family in the inner city of Erie. I've told some of you some of this before, but this is a developing story. We adopted this family mired in poverty, two little boys and three generations of women, a mom, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. And our goal at the time, 13 years ago, was to love this family and to keep these two little boys out of jail. Because three generations of men had gone to jail. And that's why they weren't there. And so we visited often. We took groceries almost every time. We celebrated holidays together. We even took the boys on vacation with us. I think we have a picture. This is Rick when he was just a little kid when we first met him. It was his first time out of Erie, first time in a swimming pool. We sensed the leading of God at every turn with this family. Right now, both boys are in their early 20s, sitting in jail cells at the Albion State Prison. And for years, we've felt this frustration and doubt and skepticism of, does God really show up? And failure. Yeah, I mean, we've had so many talks. Like, what did we do? What could we have done different? Why didn't I? Over the years, we lost touch a little bit. And I got a letter some months ago, decided to meet Rick, that little guy, over at Albion. As we sat in this gathering room, he'd come face to face with the failures of his life, just like I was coming face to face with the failures of mine, because I realized in that moment that he had met the risen Lord. Rick's failure was turned around by meeting the risen Lord, and so was mine. He'd started a Bible study on his block. He was one of the leaders in his chapel ministry, and he started telling me about this new ministry that he had started with some of his cellies on his block called the Monthly Give. And in the Monthly Give, they would once a month give this garbage bag full of stuff to an unsuspecting cellmate. And all the Christians on that block would come by and they would drop stuff in there. So sometimes money, sometimes they were collecting up to $100. Sometimes money, sometimes soap, sometimes whatever they could put in there. And then they would collect it up for the month. And while they were collecting up this stuff, Rick would also be asking God, who do you want us to give it to? Who do you want us to give this stuff to? And he was asking for prayer this one day as I was visiting him, because this guy that they were going to give it to was a hardened criminal. This guy was rough, and he never talked to anybody, and he just sat alone in his cell. And Rick said, not only do I feel compelled to give him this month's monthly give, but God's given me something to say to him. And I'm so sure of this that I actually wrote it down. God has put words in my mouth to say to this guy. And just to jump ahead, when they did this give and when he said these words, this guy dropped to his knees and surrendered his life to Christ. But when Rick was telling me about it, and telling me what happened, he said, here's what God's told me to say to him. And when I walked out of that jail that day to my car and sat in my car, I realized that those words through this young kid who I'd given up on and who I'd given up on God on his behalf, who was sitting in that prison for armed robbery, this kid that I had associated with this painful failure in my own life and the failure in his life, these words for this criminal were also words for me. He said it this way. He said, here's what God told me to tell him. He told me to tell him that Jesus is alive. He's not dead. He told me to tell him that you've been looking for him, but you've been looking in all the wrong places. And you've given up on this idea that he's still at work in a certain situation in your life. And God wanted me to remind you today, he said, that he's not dead. He's alive. And he's still at work. And he's bigger than your failures. You see, the resurrection sets in motion a new story that's not yet finished or resolved. And what happens next is up to us believers. We can't allow the resurrection account to become like a faded memory that's placed in a photo album and taken out once a year to be admired. The ending forces us. The ending of Mark's gospel forces us to enter the story. We are the next chapter. It leaves us, the reader, to make this crucial step of faith. And when we take that step, we can take it confidently because he's no longer in the tomb. So on behalf of Rick from the Albion State Prison, on behalf of me, I want to remind you today that Jesus hasn't failed and he never will.